This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhaib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
South Africa's two top political parties began the year by pledging to restore credibility amid corruption allegations against key leaders. As next year's elections draw closer, South Africa's political players are driving home the message that corruption is their main target.
That's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up.
Also, South Africa is the latest country to call on a U.S. diplomat to explain President Donald Trump's reported remarks about African and Haitian immigrants into the United States. And today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the U.S., when federal offices, banks, and public schools are closed to honor and celebrate the legacy of the now legendary civil rights leader.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story: the G5 Sahel region defense ministers met in Paris this morning with France's defense minister to focus on beefing up the coordination and acceleration of the deployment of troops in the Sahel region. The maiden military operation of the G5 mission occurred in Mali in November. However, French President Macron says much more needs to be done as various jihadist groups are joining forces to fight the G5. Reporter Catherine Field is covering developments, and she spoke with me about details of the meeting.
What the French president initially said was he wanted this G5 Sahel force to be up and running in early 2018, which is virtually now. Now, there's slippage on that date. He then later rode back on that and said, well, you're perhaps the first couple of months. And now we're looking at mid-2018 for this force to be completely operational. The problem there is that it's giving groups on the ground, these jihadist groups, traffickers groups, it's giving them a chance to coordinate and to join forces and get all their place on the ground. They've already said in the last week, a lot of these forces have come together, these jihadist forces, and say they will join together to oppose the G5 force on the ground. So that's what they're really worried about. And the particular area that the French Defense Ministry is concerned about is this, what's known as the tri-border frontier area. That's the where you have Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso borders all together. That is an area where they still haven't secured, and they're concerned that the longer it takes for this force to be completely operational, the more difficult it will be to control the vital area.
France's defense minister expressed concern of needing to have more cooperation.
Yes, there's a feeling that there's, on the one hand, not enough cooperation between the different G5 defense forces. There's not enough really being done to make sure that everyone's got the same objective. And one of the big criticisms has been that, in fact, that these G5 forces have hidden behind, if you like, the French. And they've always been pushing the French forward and saying, we'll go along with the French. Now, what the French are saying is, this is doing nothing to promote the legitimacy of your national forces. If you're always hiding behind France at the moment is very happy to take a leading role, but they want to step back. They're saying, if you continually hide behind us, push us forward, then you are not going to have that legitimacy. The other issue that the French are very concerned about is that a lot of the G5 countries are using local militias to fight rebels or jihadists and traffickers in areas where they don't have that legitimacy. And so they're saying, look, all you're doing by using these local militia is to empower them and to still stop any type of legitimacy growing up around your national forces.
So what then does France want these countries to do?
France is really very keen that they coordinate better on the international level across the G5. At home, France is very concerned that there isn't enough of what the French call the socio-political work being done. What that means is France would like to see some of the problems on the ground within the communities being dealt with. That is, in particular, corruption, the rule of law, and civilian expectations. What they're saying is, look, you can have an army, you can have a very effective army that's backed up up by France. But unless you actually deal with the problems of the ground, which is what people expect from good governance, they want to have an economy that's working, they want to feel safe in their own country. Until you start having a dialogue with grassroots, you're still just not going to be getting your country on the road. And as Emmanuel Macron, the French president, said, you're not going to be in a position where African countries will be able to deal with Africa's problems.
That was reporter Catherine Field in Paris.
South Africa is the latest country to call in a U.S. diplomat to explain President Donald Trump's reported remarks about African and Haitian immigrants to the United States. Trump reportedly used a vulgarity as he said the U.S. should allow in more people from places such as Norway. Norway's population is predominantly white. The populations of African countries and Haiti are mostly black. International and domestic organizations are expressing concern that the U.S. and its president are going down a racist path. Trump denies he's a racist and says he didn't make the reported remarks. South Africa's Department of International Relations and Cooperation was scheduled to talk today with the second-in-command at the U.S. Embassy about Trump's remarks. U.S. diplomats in Haiti and Botswana also have been summoned to discuss the matter. African ambassadors to the United Nations said their group is extremely appalled at and strongly condemns the outrageous, racist, and xenophobic remarks attributed to the President of the United States. The U.S. Congressional Black Caucus said President Trump's comments reinforce the concerns that we hear every day, that the president's slogan, Make America Great Again, is really code for making America white again.
South Africa's two top political parties began the year by pledging to restore credibility following corruption allegations against key leaders. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg that as next year's elections draw closer, South Africa's political players are driving home the message that corruption is their main target.
The ruling African National Congress and embattled President Jacob Zuma have long been accused of corruption. Critics of the government say this has left the state unable to carry out basic duties. But Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa, who succeeded Zuma as the ANC's top leader last month, says that will change. Here he is in the coastal city of East London over the weekend, taking several not-so-subtle jabs at Zuma, who was accused of siphoning off tens of millions of dollars and of letting a wealthy Indian family have undue influence over the government.
These challenges have been exacerbated by state capture through which billions of rands have been illegally diverted to individuals, corruption in state-owned enterprises and other public institutions have undermined our government's programs to address poverty and unemployment, and they have weakened those institutions.
The ANC has dominated national politics for a quarter century, but has lost ground in recent years to the opposition Democratic Alliance, which captured three major cities in 2016's municipal polls. Meanwhile, the DA is having its own reckoning, charging Cape Town Mayor Patricia de Lille with corruption under the party's own disciplinary process. De Lille reported to work Monday, but her party relegated many key responsibilities, like the city's dire water crisis, to other officials. In Johannesburg, the city's mayor said Monday he was firing a top city finance official amid allegations of nepotism and undue influence. Party leader Musi Maimane spoke to reporters Sunday in Cape Town.
The true test of any political party is what it does when confronted with serious allegations of political dysfunction, maladministration, and governance failures. The DA, unlike many of our political competitors, stands largely alone in acting with resolve in confronting such issues, even when those decisions, in fact, come at a very serious political cost.
Political analyst Ralph Matega says these events may indicate that the two parties, which often try to cast themselves as each other's antithesis, may not be so different after all. He says he believes both leaders' words are sincere, but notes that they both face challenges in bringing their own parties into line.
The challenge that the DA is facing are not so different from that of the ANC. And actually, if you look at the allegations of corruption within the DA in the city of Johannesburg, you have the MMC of Finance being suspended, and you have Delile as well, allegations coming out against her regarding impropriety. What that shows is that the DA is also battling with corruption within its ranks, and also the problem seems to be emerging regarding the integrity of internal processes in dealing with this.
But he says one thing is clear. South Africa's parties need to scrub themselves thoroughly within before they can show their shiny new faces to voters next year. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day in the United States, honoring the legacy of the civil rights leader. But 50 years after his assassination, how to continue King's work is a matter for debate. Some emphasize self-reliance in the struggle for racial equality and prosperity, while others say that policymaking, social activism, and diversity education are key to addressing the inequities that persist. VOA's Adam Phillips reports from New York.
While Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was highly controversial in his day, the meaning of some of his most famous words is still debated today. Here's an excerpt from his 1963 I Have a Dream speech.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
The phrase, content of their character, conveys the essence of King's statement, says Jason Riley. Riley is a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative research group in New York City, and the author of Please Stop Helping Us, How Liberals Make It Harder for Blacks to Succeed. Riley also happens to be African American.
I think King had it right, and I think many of the efforts to help blacks in recent decades have interfered with that necessary self-development, disincentives to work, making excuses for educational lags instead of focusing on asking children to try harder and study more, going easy on criminals, removing stigmas to unlawful behavior.
Riley says that the civil rights struggle for equal protection and equal treatment under the law was necessary at that time.
I think King's greatest accomplishments were the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Now that the big wars have been fought and won, you have a group of black leaders looking for relevance, and their efforts today are often counterproductive. Their attitude is that so long as racism still exists, we can't hold blacks responsible for these negative outcomes we see today. And so I think they've taken a completely different approach than the one taken by King.
That approach includes affirmative action programs that give preferential treatment to minorities in education and employment.
But they simply have not gotten the job done.
Activist and educator Diane Goodman offers different reasons as to why that is. She conducts diversity and social justice workshops for corporations, universities, and community groups.
It's about helping educate people to understand larger systems of social inequality and how that operates on individual and interpersonal as well as institutional levels.
Goodman says that despite anti-discrimination laws, African Americans continue to face bias. She points out studies that show that blacks tend to get harsher prison sentences than whites for the same crimes. And in schools, studies show that black children are disciplined more harshly than white students and miss out on the mentoring and financial resources available to many whites. That's why Goodman says institutions must be relentless in putting anti-discrimination policies into practice.
And it is making a commitment and saying, we're going to ensure that our board, we're going to ensure that our faculty, we're going to ensure that our leadership and our managers reflect the larger society. And so all that is the personal work to understand my biases so I can then look more critically and think more creatively about how things could be different that would be more equitable and inclusive.
Many conservatives and liberals tend to agree that a truly colorblind post-racial society is far off. Jason Riley, for example, says that groups like Black Lives Matter contradict Martin Luther King Jr.'s assertion that it's character alone that truly matters. Diane Goodman points to ways that King connected racism with class conflict and militarism. She says that by doing so, King was far more radical than most Americans, black or white, fully grasp. Either way, 50 years after his murder, Martin Luther King's dream remains largely unrealized. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Coming up on 20 Minutes Past the Hour, this is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Uganda is mulling over the idea of creating its own social media platforms, but social media users and government critics see this as a potential effort to control free expression. Halima Athmani reports from Kampala.
Facebook and Twitter should brace themselves for competition from Uganda. With no name yet or date on when the new services will be operational, the Uganda Communications Commission is planning to launch its own social media platforms. Commission Director Godfrey Mutabazi says Uganda has many young people who have come up with innovations and applications that can be deployed to serve the population.
There is open information for everything. So we have got over almost 70% penetration. We are moving into digital era, data communication. We hope that by the end of this year, 20-25%, maybe up 30% of Ugandans will be on data communication. So we shall access the information, education ways, research, name it, will be available.
Nicholas Opio, Executive Director of Chapter 4 Uganda, a local civil liberties organization, says Uganda is not seeking to develop its own social media space because it appreciates the innovative power of social media. He fears a darker purpose.
One, I don't believe they can do it, but if they want to do it, it is not for the best of intentions. Recent studies have shown that the government of Uganda is now involved in active filtering of particular information, namely information about corruption, information about same-sex relations, critical of government policies on the first family. That's what they're trying to do, because the biggest threat to this government now is an informed citizenry.
In 2016, the Ugandan government shut down social media twice, on election day and during President Yoweri Museveni's swearing-in ceremony. For social media users like Jackie Kemgisa, a move by the government regulator to set up its own social media is cause to worry.
As a person who uses social media and whose source of employment, everything that I do is online, it was a horrible idea. At first, I thought it was a joke. So counting on the sad part of it that they don't have the money. And if they do, well, then Ugandans will have to re-strategize, go back to the drawing board and see how we can still fight for our freedoms.
Critics say a social media platform controlled by the government will put Uganda in the same league as countries such as Iran, China and North Korea. But the Uganda Communications Commission has described those who see this innovation as eroding freedom of speech as patronizing. The government agency insists they just want to keep hate speech out of Ugandan social media and says the new platforms are going to be positive. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
The United Nations is calling for the permanent reopening of all of Yemen's seaports to allow vital, life-saving humanitarian and commercial cargo to enter. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The Saudi-led coalition partially lifted its blockade of Yemen seaports on December 20th. Since then, the United Nations reports 13 vessels have delivered food and much-needed fuel to this seriously deprived country through the Red Sea ports of Hodeidah and Salif. The UN welcomes this as a constructive step, but the spokesman for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says it is not enough. He notes Yemen imports about 90% of its staple food and nearly all its fuel and medicine.
We call on the coalition to continue allowing vessels into the Red Sea ports and also for the Houthis to desist from threatening this vital access route. The steady flow of imports is a lifeline for millions of vulnerable Yemeni people.
Saudi Arabia imposed a total blockade on Yemen's air and sea ports on November 6th in retaliation for a rebel Houthi ballistic missile attack near the capital's Riyadh airport. The United Nations considers Yemen one of the world's worst humanitarian crises. It says 22 million people in Yemen are in need of humanitarian assistance, with nearly 8 million on the brink of famine. Laerke tells VOA, this is a man-made disaster.
When we talk about 22 million people, that's almost the entirety of the population, then it is critical, I think, to understand that it is man-made. We need a political solution, and we welcome any and all efforts to find such a solution. In the meantime, it is critical that these ports are kept open.
The Saudi-led coalition entered Yemen's conflict in support of the government in March 2015. Since then, more than 10,000 civilians have been killed and over 40,000 injured. The UN and other human rights groups blame most of these casualties on the coalition's aerial and ground campaign against the Houthi rebels. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Deadly traffic accidents are more than just individual tragedies. They are a drag on economic growth in developing countries, according to a new World Bank report. The study is among the first to show that investing in road safety in low- and middle-income countries would raise national incomes. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
Traffic accidents are a top 10 cause of death worldwide, according to the World Health Organization. 90% happen in the developing world. But the issue does not get much attention, says World Bank transportation expert Dipen Bose.
There is not a lot of political will in many low- and middle-income countries to take definitive actions to reduce road deaths and injuries.
The study Bose co-authored focused on five countries: China, India, Thailand, the Philippines, and Tanzania. It used mathematical models to estimate what each country's economy would gain from safer roads over a 24-year period.
So the results were quite startling.
Thailand would see a 22% boost to national income by cutting traffic deaths in half. The country's high rates of both economic growth and traffic accidents meant it had the most to gain. Tanzania would gain 7%. The other countries fell in between. These kinds of economic gains are something no national government can ignore, Bose said.
It gives kind of the economic story of why it is important to take strong actions on road safety.
The report says enforcing speed limits, helmet and seatbelt laws, and cutting down on drunk driving are low-hanging fruit. But drivers are only partly responsible for traffic deaths, says road safety expert Anna Bray Sharpen at the World Resources Institute.
If the system's not safe, if people don't have the opportunity to cross the road safely or drive in a safe vehicle, then a small error can result in a fatality, and that should not be the case.
Bray Sharpen co-authored a separate report that says city planners and government officials are responsible for building safety into the transportation system. That often does not happen, she says.
So, for example, many cities have applied highway design guidelines even to their city streets, which basically are designed to facilitate maximum traffic flow and speed.
But they are not designed for bikers or pedestrians, she adds.
People tend to take risks to try and cross the road. And that comes back to this issue of whether this is a question of personal responsibility or a co-responsibility between governments and planners and people using the road.
The report offers guidance on how to incorporate safety into road design. It's timely, Bray Sharpen adds, because many developing countries are currently planning major road infrastructure projects.
Basically, there's a window of opportunity now to integrate safety into that planning, which is much more cost-effective than trying to retrofit safe elements of design into the system later on.
And these roads will be around for decades, she added. If they're not built safely, they will be taking a toll for a long time to come. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Bate, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.